Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, the 24th. And let's see what else is going on here. I emailed everybody. A sign-in sheet is going around. It's okay if you guys keep talking. It's okay because I can just keep turning the volume up. But the email I sent you is a figure that you have to draw in lab on a blank piece of paper, which is an action potential. All right, so you got to do that this week for extra credit. Make sure you do that. And it's the same figure that's in your book. It's modified a little bit. I added some labels for the different colored columns. I think they're gray and green and violet. At least that's what I've been told they are. So anything that's close to gray or green, it might be more yellow, I'm not sure. And lavender, a violet kind of color. Make sure you know what those things are. Okay, well, I don't want to start this thing right now, so let's cancel. So let me write something on the board. Here we have, let's see, ADP plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP. So you should tell me something about that reaction. Is it in terms of its thermodynamics? Is it exergonic or endergonic? Where should I put energy on this equation? On the left or on the right? Okay. We need energy to make ATP. So I need it over here on the left-hand side of the equation. Energy. All right, in order to add that inorganic phosphate to PI. So this is an endergonic reaction. All right, endergonic. And what's the delta G for it? You don't have to tell me the number, just give me the sign. Positive delta G. All right, so it takes energy. So this reaction can happen as long as you have what? As long as you have energy to drive this equation. Okay, so I just want to make sure that we get that basic understanding down really, really well. And on the slide on the right, which is over here, let's see if I can make it a little bit darker in class. That's too dark, huh? I'm not what's better. Let's see, that's the only switch I have. And that one, that's not going to work. Okay, so it's got to be like this. All right, that's as dark as I can get it. Okay, so look at the slide on the right over there. And we call this what? Cellular respiration. A couple different pathways. We have two different pathways here. One is anaerobic metabolism, where we take glucose that's in a cell and break it all the way down to lactic acid. We call that anaerobic metabolism. And then we have aerobic metabolism, which again starts with glucose. And that glucose is broken down all the way to CO2 and water right here. And you got to know the different compartments of all these different reactions. But what's the purpose of anaerobic metabolism versus aerobic metabolism, or anaerobic, there's oxygen that's not on this sheet right here. So oxygen is being consumed by aerobic respiration. All right, but what's the point of this, of these two different kinds of respirations? Is it to produce lactic acid? Is it to produce carbon dioxide? And water, of course, is very important in your body. Is it the reason for aerobic respiration to make water? So those are all just questions that I'm asking you. Okay, is that really a good purpose for, or is it to get rid of glucose? Right, we're also getting rid of glucose. So those are some questions. Now, on this slide right here, at the very beginning I said there's one molecule that's not on this slide. And a lot of you seem to know what molecule that was. And I told you to draw it on this slide right here. What was that? ATP. So I want you to know the purpose of anaerobic metabolism and aerobic respiration, or aerobic metabolism, right, in terms of either getting rid of something in the body or producing something that the body needs. All right, and the hint was it's not on this slide right here. So the purpose of aerobic respiration is not to produce CO2, not to produce water. Right, it's going to be important for producing something else. And of course I have a hint right on the board that we just talked about, that I wrote on the board for you. All right, so last time we stopped talking about, we ended the discussion when we got into the Krebs cycle. All right, so let's just kind of review these different metabolic pathways. The first pathway that we talked about was taking glucose to pyruvic acid, and we call that glycolysis. All right, so is that the point of glycolysis, to make pyruvic acid? Okay, and I want you to answer that in about a week or so, maybe later today. So that's glycolysis, you know, that happens in the cytoplasm. Then under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid, which is basically like glucose cut in half, it's a 3-carbon molecule, enters the mitochondria, and then there's a preparatory reaction, signified by this little tiny arrow right here on this slide. And if we look on the slide on the left, the PowerPoint slide, we see the preparatory reaction. And we take a 3-carbon pyruvic acid and convert it into a 2-carbon unit by decarboxylation. So a CO2 comes off. And of course, you get rid of that from your body. You exhale that CO2. And that produces an acetyl-CoA. But also in the process, it also produces an NADH, right? So what does it do to NAD plus? Does it oxidize it or reduce it? Going from NAD plus to NADH is a reduction. It's a reduction reaction, right? So NADH is accepting some electrons, and it just so happens that those high energy electrons can be used later on. And maybe I'm going to have to write that on the board right now, what we use those high energy electrons for. All right, but that ends up then producing acetyl-CoA, which can enter the Krebs cycle. So let's just write down what that NADH can produce. So it is a high energy molecule. NADH can be used to make 3 ATP. So for that reason, we don't want to just throw NADH away. It's a very important molecule. And fortunately, this preparatory reaction does make some NADH. All right, so acetyl-CoA then enters the Krebs cycle. So if we have a 4-carbon unit and add 2 carbons to it, we end up with a 6-carbon unit. So that kicks off the Krebs cycle. And let's look at the next slide. A number of intermediates, all right, are produced. So in one of the first steps of the Krebs cycle, we have an NAD plus being converted. It becomes reduced, and therefore it becomes NADH. All right, so this is inside the mitochondria, and what can you do with that NADH? You can make 3 ATPs out of it. Okay, so that's pretty important. There's a decarboxylation reaction. What do you do with this CO2? You throw it away, right? You just toss it away. All right, and here's another interconversion. I don't want you to know these intermediates right here, but there's another decarboxylation. All right, so now we have 3 decarboxylations producing CO2s. What was the unit that entered the mitochondria in the beginning that started this whole thing? It was the end product of glycolysis. What's the end product of glycolysis? Pyruvate or pyruvic acid. Ooh, maybe I haven't said that, but pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same thing. Just like lactate and lactic acid are exactly the same thing. So don't be confused. I interchange those terms all the time. So pyruvic acid enters. How many carbons are in pyruvic acid? There's 3, right? Because it's glucose, which is 6, that got chopped in half. So that pyruvic acid ends up as what? Basically carbon dioxide in that preparatory reaction. Here's the second one, and here's the third carbon. So that pyruvic acid has been completely broken down to CO2. All right, but we're not done with the Krebs cycle just yet. So in this next step, it produces another NADH. And then what can a cell do with this NADH? This you don't want to throw away, like CO2. It makes 3 more ATP for you. All right. Also in this step right here, there is a GTP that is produced. And GTP has basically the same free energy as ATP. So these can be what? Freely interconverted. These are neither exothermic or, exergonic or endergonic reactions. So if you make a GTP, it can be easily converted into an ATP. So that's handy. In this next reaction over here, we have an FADH2 from FAD. So what form is FADH2? Is it oxidized or reduced? It's reduced, right? Because it gets some electrons from succinate here, so it becomes reduced. So we have FADH2. And in mitochondria, if all things are going exactly well and nice, it can make 2 ATP for every FADH2. So do you want to throw FADH2 away?
No.
No, important energy molecule. All right, we're still not done with Krebs cycle. Through some other interconversions, there's one more step that, what, reduces NAD into NADH. All right, so again, some more energy is harnessed from that initial acetyl group that was put into the Krebs cycle, because what can you make with that NADH? Three more ATPs. All right, so let's figure out from at least one turn of the Krebs cycle how much ATP is going to be produced. Starting with citric acid right here. So let's ignore this acetyl-CoA, the preparatory reaction. So for one turn of the Krebs cycle, we have what? 1, 2, 3 NADHs that are made, 1 FADH2, and 1 ATP. All right, so we got 3 ATPs for every NADH times what? For a Krebs cycle, times 3 for every single turn. And then we've got 2, all right, that's just times 1. All right, so what do we got? We've got 9. And then we've got 2 right here. Okay, so that's 11. But what did I forget? I forgot that ATP that's being made. So I'm going to put right here, I'm going to put what? GTP. All right, and that's going to produce just 1 ATP right here. So we put another one. So for one turn of the Krebs cycle, let's see if this makes sense to me. We've got 11, 12 ATPs that are made with one turn of the Krebs cycle. So kind of in your notes, highlight this number right here. Let's see, something's bothering me about that. No, that's right. I can't figure out what's wrong, so that's got to be right. All right, so there's more energy in NADH than there is in FADH2. So since we're making ATP, what can you tell me about the thermodynamics of the Krebs cycle? Okay, is the Krebs cycle endergonic or exergonic? Okay, in order to make ATP, okay, what kind of reaction is the building of ATP? It is endergonic, and what do you have to have to drive an endergonic reaction? You got to couple it with an exergonic reaction. So the Krebs cycle is highly exergonic. It's releasing a lot of energy, and that energy ends up as what? High energy electrons in NADH, FADH2, and then as a high energy chemical bond in ATP. So the Krebs cycle is exergonic. It produces a lot of energy. That mitochondria then have figured out a way to incorporate into ATP, because making ATP requires energy, right? You need energy right here. All right, so that's pretty much for the Krebs cycle. So where does the Krebs cycle take place? So let's just review some things about the Krebs cycle. Where does it take place? Only inside mitochondria, not in the cytoplasm. So we need functioning mitochondria for that to happen. Where is CO2 produced in your body? Mitochondria, right? First, and give me the two metabolic pathways that produce CO2 inside mitochondria. First is, you see it right here, what do we call this right here? This is the Krebs cycle. And the second pathway is, the slide before this one here, is what? This preparatory reaction when pyruvic acid is converted into acetyl-CoA. Okay, that's another decarboxylation reaction right here. So a 3-carbon unit is converted into a 2-carbon unit. That is a result of a decarboxylation. And again, that's inside what? A mitochondria. Because remember, pyruvic acid can't even enter without oxygen. So special things happen inside the mitochondria. So here is that little synopsis slide, 1 GTP, 3 NADHs, and 1 FADH2 for the Krebs cycle. Okay. So that's going to take us pretty close to dealing with those high energy electrons that are being carried by NADH and FADH2. So what do we call a big organic molecule that is carrying some kind of metabolic intermediate between two sets of chemical reactions. That is a coenzyme, right? So don't forget, NAD and FADH are coenzymes. So where are we over here on the right-hand slide? So we're done with the Krebs cycle, and you could fill in a couple of the important steps right here, like what? CO2 is coming out. And what is carrying these electrons over to the electron transport chain? This is the last chemical reaction that we're going to look at. It is what? The NADH and FADH2 are carrying high electrons, high energy electrons, over to electron transport right here. Okay. So the next slide that we have is also inside the mitochondria. And it is the electron transport chain. And these are proteins or modified proteins that have other kinds of elements on them, maybe some iron elements and other kinds of metal ions, that can undergo a series of oxidation-reduction reactions. So they can accept high-energy electrons and pass them on to other molecules. So what's a good source of high-energy electrons? We just got done talking about it. It is what? NADH and also FADH2 that I'm pointing out on the PowerPoint slide right here. Okay, and so now we have a plot of the electron transport chain as electrons get passed from one chemical to another down the electron transport chain. What can you tell me about the energy levels? It's plotted versus energy. Right, so this is just the free energy change as these electrons. So what about these two electrons right here compared to these down over here? These first two have what? Higher, the same, or less energy? It has higher energy. So when you go from high energy to lower energy, what kind of reaction is that? Is that endergonic or exergonic? Exergonic, right? It's releasing energy. And what can an exergonic reaction do? It can be linked to an endergonic reaction to make it go. All right, and so what can you tell me about ADP plus inorganic phosphate making ATP? That's endergonic. It's coupled to the flow of electrons through these cytochromes in the electron transport chain. And so the electron transport chain, for every two electrons that are transferred to it from NADH, can produce 1, 2, 3 ATPs. All right, so for every two electrons. So now we just have to multiply how many pairs of electrons that we got through glycolysis and through the Krebs cycle and the preparatory reactions, then to calculate how many ATPs can be produced by this process right here. And this is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so this is the fourth process. If we look on the slide on the right over here, electron transport chain, right, is the physical machinery that produces or operates oxidative phosphorylation. So we are, and we call it phosphorylation because what are we phosphorylating? We're phosphorylating ADP to make ATP out of it. So this is why we call it oxidative phosphorylation. The other important point, why is it called oxidative? Because the very last electron acceptor is oxygen. Oxygen has to be available. And we kind of knew that just as a definition already. But oxygen will accept these electrons, which are now at a fairly low energy, and it will take some protons, combine them together to produce water. So the very last molecule that is being produced is water. And these electrons won't flow through these different cytochromes unless they have some place to go. And where do those electrons have to go in order to keep the electron transport chain open? They have to be accepted by oxygen, right? So that's why oxygen is important. And how do you get oxygen in your body? By inhaling, right? Because oxygen is at a high concentration in our atmosphere. So we breathe in oxygen, and oxygen is necessary for everything that happens inside the mitochondria, but especially this electron transport chain. So one way of thinking of this ETC, instead of calling it electron transport chain all the time, let's just call it ETC for short. You could think of ETC as being like a wire that you're used to in your house. Okay, and in your house, there's a switch that you flip on and off to get the electrons to flow. But what's the switch that gets electrons to flow through ETC in a mitochondria? It can turn the flow off or turn the flow on. It is oxygen right here.
Right? If oxygen is not available, then all of these electrons don't have any place to go and they stop moving. And what else happens then? ATP is not performed, or is not produced. And in your brain, how many seconds of consciousness do you have when we take oxygen away from your brain? Yeah, about two, right? And because by then, your brain has used up so much ATP, it can't even maintain consciousness. All right, so we see that on this energy level diagram, a couple other things. We have NADH at a higher energy level than FADH2. So this is why NADH can produce 3 ATP, but FADH can only produce 2 ATP because it's donating electrons at a lower energy level to electron transport chain. So that's why we have it marked on the board over here. FADH2, 2 ATPs, and NADH3. What else about this slide? These proteins, FMN and the cytochromes, are located on the Christi membrane of mitochondria. Can you remember mitochondria? Maybe we should draw that out really, really quick. See if I have my marker working. So for sure, you can tell me this is mitochondria right here. It's sort of an interesting organelle because not only does it have one membrane surrounding it, it's what we call a membrane-bound organelle, but it also has what? Another membrane on the inside. So it has a double membrane with these folds in it, like this. Okay? So yeah, let's get our definitions down. So we have a space between the two membranes, and we have a space on the inside of the inner membrane. So here is the outer membrane. Outer membrane right here. And here is the... That's the inner membrane, but it's got another name. That's called the Christi membrane. All right, so that's the Christi right there. This space between the membranes is the intermembrane space. And this space over here is different than the intermembrane space. This is what we call the matrix. All right, so matrix is used for a lot of different things in biology and mathematics, right? It could also be the stuff outside, the extracellular space in a connective tissue, but the matrix is also that inner space right there. So the cytochromes are located on the Christi membrane. So maybe I'll draw that in a little bit of blue color right here. All right, so you have the cytochromes embedded in the membrane. Remember membranes? What's a good model of a membrane to think about in this particular case? Maybe a simple phospholipid bilayer? Or what's a better way of thinking about it? How about the fluid mosaic model? Because not only the phospholipid bilayer, what can you put into that phospholipid bilayer? You can put all kinds of other kinds of proteins, receptor proteins or enzymes, or even cytochromes that are specialized for oxidation reduction reactions. So these electrons just flow right along that membrane in those cytochromes right there on the Christi membrane. All right, so this is why oxygen is important. Don't forget, what's the last molecule that's produced by the electron transport chain? Water. And that's kind of interesting because water is what? Also a very important solvent in your body. So not only is water an important solvent, but it participates as what, an intermediate or a product of many chemical reactions in your body, including this one that produces all of this ATP. All right, so that's what we mean by aerobic respiration. So make sure, so what are we missing from this initial diagram right here? What's the important thing? What's being produced? Yeah, ATP is being produced by all of these, what, exergonic reactions? All right, so now you might be really interested in to find out, well, how on earth are all of these exergonic reactions used to run that endergonic reaction that produces ATP? All right, so that's what we're going to look at next. Oxidative phosphorylation. There's one last thing I want to talk about before we get to that last model. All right, so NADH and FADH carry high energy electrons into the electron transport chain. But there are other ways that a cell, even within the Krebs cycle, can make ATP. All right. For instance, this step right here between alpha-ketoglutarate and succinate right here, there is ATP that is produced directly, not through the electron transport chain, but by direct chemical reactions in the Krebs cycle. And don't forget, there are enzymes that run all of these chemical reactions. And so what do we call the reactants that participate in a enzyme-catalyzed reaction? Substrates, right? All right, so ADP is actually a substrate, or GDP is a substrate for this particular chemical reaction. All right, so since it's a substrate, the production of ATP that's produced directly by an enzyme is what we call substrate-level phosphorylation. So Krebs cycle can't work without oxygen because it shuts down the electron transport chain. But this reaction right here, we don't see oxygen directly being used. All right, so we call this substrate-level phosphorylation. Come on, cursor. Substrate-level phosphorylation. But the ATP that's made via the electron transport chain is what we call, what? Oxidative phosphorylation. So there's two kinds of phosphorylation. Now what about, what do we call that process? Glucose going through pyruvic acid. That was glycolysis. Where did that take place? In the cytoplasm, or cytosol would be a better way of talking about it. And is oxygen necessary for that? It's not necessary, right? That's just a part of the anaerobic pathway. All right, so if oxygen is not necessary to run glycolysis, what are some of the products of glycolysis? Can you remember any of the products of glycolysis? Let's go back and take a look at it right here. What are some products? Well, we got some NADH. Oh, that's nice, because what can you do with NADH? You can make ATP, not directly via glycolysis, but NADH has to be shipped into the mitochondria, and those electrons have to be donated to the electron transport chain, and then you can make some more ATPs out of it. But here is ADP as a substrate for this enzyme. So this is, would you call this oxidative phosphorylation? So a good clue would be, is oxygen necessary for glycolysis? No. So does it make sense to call this oxidative phosphorylation if oxygen is not necessary for it? No. And what's the only other kind of phosphorylation process that we talked about? Substrate level, right? So glycolysis produces ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. So there's two places that produces ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. One is glycolysis, and it produces 2 net ATP, and the other is, let me just flip over to this other slide, is the Krebs cycle. Every turn of the Krebs cycle produces 1 ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. Okay. So it's a little bit tricky because remember, this is not dependent on oxygen, glycolysis is not dependent on oxygen, but the Krebs cycle is, but that's still substrate level phosphorylation when ATP is directly made by the operation of the Krebs cycle. Let me see what this other figure is. Oh, okay, I know what that other figure is. All right, so let me ask you a few questions, just as a review. Now, you have four terms that sound very similar to each other. You have glycolysis. You have glycogenolysis. You have gluconeogenesis. Okay, and what else do you have? Oh, you got glycogenesis. Does anybody have any question on those terms and how to label this diagram right here? You want to go over this one pretty good? All right. There's something that's been kind of floating in the back of my mind that I have to talk about right now, which takes us away a little bit from the class, but it's not bad. There are many websites that you can import figures, and you can make them interactive. And like Purpose Games is one of them, is a really nice way, and you could actually look at purposegames.com and find some. But usually instructors don't put illustrations from a textbook in there, so they might not be really accurate. You have to really check and see that they are accurate. The other thing is that these figures in the textbook are copyrighted, right, by McGraw-Hill right here. And you would actually have to write and get permission to publish one of their pictures on another website. All right, so I'd be a little bit careful about taking pictures that I give you in an electronic format, you know, that I've modified and put them on another website, open access website. So you don't really have permission to do that. And somebody could get sued. I don't know if I could get sued since I didn't do it, but it's possible. Right? There's a kind of safeguards when you're working in an educational environment, and maybe if you put one or two pictures up there, it doesn't decrease the value of a textbook to a company, but you never know how a lawyer is going to take it, right? And so be a little careful. I would say that as a general rule, don't take something that's in your textbook that you paid for, okay, but you don't have the copyright for it, take that picture and stick it on the website for everybody to have for free. But, you know, it's kind of sad because you can do some really nice things. Like you can make drag and drop exercises and things like that. I know anatomy has a lot of those. Physiology books don't have that so much, but I'm trying to get the company to be a little bit more serious about that. So be careful putting textbook images onto other people's websites or other companies, because then that other company might actually claim a copyright on that information. But then McGraw-Hill knows that they have a copyright, so that could just cause a big mess, right? So be a little bit careful with that. And of course, in lab, you're welcome to take videos and pictures, but just make sure you never take another picture or video of a student, right? You can take a picture of your setup and all the chemistry that you're doing, but never get another student in the background unless you get written permission to do that, right? You don't want to put that on the web ever. Okay, so where are we? Let's get back to this electron transport chain right here. Okay, and that's a part of aerobic respiration. Why is that a part of aerobic respiration? Because oxygen is the molecule that's necessary to keep these electrons flowing down the electron transport chain. Okay, so let's show you how oxidative phosphorylation works as opposed to substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, I'll let you catch up to this slide right here. I think I've talked about everything that's on those previous slides already. So here we have a very nice illustration of a zoomed in, just very small slice of this mitochondria that we drew on the board. So we just got a really small slice. We just zoomed into this area right here. So what do we have? Well, I see a couple of phospholipid bilayers right there. Sweet. You're familiar with that. So here's the outer membrane, right? This is just the cytosol in the cell. But now if you go in through these membranes, you're inside the mitochondria. So here's the outer membrane. Here's the intermembrane space. Here's the second membrane. What do we call that second membrane? That's the Christie membrane. Oh, it's labeled inner mitochondrial membrane right here. Same thing. Probably would be better if you just call it Christie. But this is an exam figure, so probably I have it maybe on an exam. Inner mitochondrial membrane, but you should know that's the Christie. And these are nice phospholipid bilayers. And in that bilayer, you can dissolve, what, all kinds of other nifty molecules, especially what, like cytochromes, that can transfer electrons from one molecule to another undergoing a series of oxidation reduction reactions. All right, so, and these proteins can be what? They can be receptors, or they can be enzymes, or channels, or they could be enzyme channels, or any kind of combination of the above. So here is, let's just say maybe this is FMN, and when NADH releases high energy electrons onto this protein right here, and these electrons then are used to reduce the next molecule. It releases energy to this protein. It changes conformation, and it can take protons from the matrix right here and put them in the intermembrane space. So this is what we call a proton pump, because it's what? Taking protons from low concentration to high concentration. What do you need to move something from low to high concentration? You need energy, right? And what's the energy? The energy is coming from the high energy electrons in NADH. Remember, go back to that previous slide. NADH has a really high level of free energy, right? Then the electrons flow down eventually into a second proton pump. And when it flows out, more protons get pumped from low concentration to high concentration. Where? Where's the high concentration of protons being developed? That's in the intermembrane space. Where's that labeled on here? Ah, here, right there. It doesn't have a lead line. That's it. Into the intermembrane space. All right, and we're still not done. Then there's a third proton pump. As the electrons flow through this third proton pump, it pumps protons from low concentration to high in the intermembrane space. All right, so now we have a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and low inside the matrix. So where do those protons want to go? Are they happy? Are they stable in the intermembrane space? Or where do they want to go? They want to go down their concentration gradient. And where's the concentration gradient? It's high in the intermembrane space, low inside the matrix, so they're just dying to get into the matrix right here. All right, but what did we say about a concentration gradient? It is an energy source. It's a source of energy. And what can you do with energy? What's a really good working definition of energy? It's something that allows you to do work, right? All right, so as these protons get pumped into this intermembrane space, there is a fourth protein, and it's this complex right here. It's called ATP synthase, or sometimes it's called ATP synthetase. It's a channel that allows protons through, and protons want to just diffuse from high concentration to low, but there's a lot of energy in that concentration gradient, and this protein is nice and sophisticated. As proteins flow back down into the matrix, right, it can then take ADP, inorganic phosphate, and phosphorylate ATP and make an ATP out of it. All right, so that's how, and this is what we call the chemiasmotic theory of how ATP is made in mitochondria. It's made by using these proton pumps to establish a very high gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. And then protons, as they flow back down into the matrix through this ATP synthetase, that produces ATP. Okay, so FADH2 would release electrons, not at this first pump, but someplace right before the second pump. Okay, so it can't produce quite as many ATPs, right, because it's not pumping the same amount of protons into the intermembrane space. All right, so if you have a pretty good feel for diffusion, right, and knowing how things work by diffusion, then I think you should be able to understand this chemiosmotic theory pretty nice, right? And just figure out where all these different proteins are and the different membranes and the different spaces inside the mitochondria. All right, let me look at this slide right here just to see if all right, so these proton pumps will work if these electrons have a place to go. And where do they go? They go into oxygen, right? So that's why mitochondria need oxygen inside the matrix to have those electrons move through the electron transport chain so that protons can be pumped into the intermembrane space so that those protons then diffuse back through this ATP synthase or synthetase, and that produces ATP for us. So that's how these exergonic reactions are used to drive this. What kind of reaction is this? ADP plus PI going to ATP? That's an endergonic reaction. It needs energy in order for that to happen, and it gets the energy from what? The gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. And the ATP synthase is the machinery that allows that to happen. All right, so that's the importance of oxygen in mitochondria. So, do you like mitochondria or not? Yes. Okay, I like mitochondria too, but I want to change your opinion just a little bit. Now, don't forget that we're a symbiotic organism. Mitochondria really have a bacterial origin, okay? And these mitochondria like to maintain a high concentration gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. They like to have high protons in the inner membrane space, very low concentration of protons in the matrix right here. And that can be accomplished very nicely as long as they have what molecule? I'm circling it right here. Oxygen. In order to let those electrons flow, then mitochondria are very happy to make ATP for us. But let's take oxygen away and think about a mitochondria. Okay, if we take oxygen away, what happens to these electrons? They can't flow through the cytochrome system. And when they're not flowing through the cytochrome system, what about these proton pumps? Are they working or not? They're not working. So now we have an unhappy mitochondria, because mitochondria want to have what? High protons in this intermembrane space. But it doesn't have electron transport to do that work for it now. But guess what? This ATP synthase right here is still in the membrane and still operational. So when oxygen goes away, guess what happens to this ATP synthase? it not only stops, but it works in the reverse direction. It takes protons from the matrix and it puts it into the intermembrane space, so now the mitochondria is happy. But look what happens to ATP. If we run ATP synthase in the reverse direction, what happens to ATP? It gets used up. It gets converted to ATP. Now, what do you think about that? I don't like that, right? Because I like ATP. I don't like ADP. So under anaerobic conditions, when a cell is starved for oxygen, when a mitochondria is starved for oxygen, right, mitochondria actually are harmful to us because they help deplete our bodies of ATP. And we haven't figured out a way how to turn that off. But that would be really nice. If somebody has a heart attack or stroke and oxygen is not getting to the brain, it would be nice to turn off mitochondria so they don't, what, gobble up a bunch of ATP that the other processes, life processes in your cells require. And that would be nice to figure out how to switch that synthetase on and off. And probably we know how to do it because some people can live for a really long time without oxygen. Does anybody know what kind of person can live for a really long time without oxygen? Like a newborn. Like sometimes maybe somebody has an umbilical cord wrapped around their neck and they could be maybe 5 minutes before they're born and get that umbilical cord unwrapped and everything, right? And so that baby's brain is devoid of oxygen and that baby's brain knows how to survive that situation, maybe by some kind of control via mitochondria that are in the brain. So it's probably available to us, we just haven't figured out how to do that. So just be aware that in your career, you're going to have to be aware of what? A lot more biochemistry and really cool ways that we can treat people with ischemic injuries like heart attacks and strokes and things like that. Yeah.
If the cord is wrapped around their neck,
if it's wrapped around tight, then the blood vessels get occluded and no blood goes into the baby. Yeah. So depending on the nature of that blockage. And even if an infant, right, doesn't start breathing right away, that's not such a really big concern. You got to get them breathing pretty quick, but they can survive a lot longer than adults can. All right, so their brains can go probably minutes without oxygen and not seconds, which is pretty amazing. Probably has something to do with this system right here. All right, so chemiosmotic theory. What the heck does that mean? It has to do with chemicals making ATP, but it's using what? The chemical gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. And when we say theory, what do we mean? That it has been proven by numerous experiments and double-checked by researchers all over the world. So it's definitely something that we can take for granted. Okay. So it's not just a hypothesis. All right, so ATP formation can be made by two ways. We talked about that a little bit. We got substrate-level phosphorylation. Right, and that's just when bonds are broken and remade. ATP is made in glycolysis directly glycolysis, and also in the Krebs cycle, the GTP. That's direct level phosphorylation, and then oxidative phosphorylation that requires what? The electron transport chain. And so now let's try to calculate how many ATPs are produced by these different pathways. So let me see, these slides are pretty good. All right, but what's really good is this table, but we got a better table in the new edition. So let's go to the new table right here. All right, so this is the table that you have in your book, but here is the updated table. It's both 5.2. This is the one I really like in your textbook. And I'll show you what the simple difference is. Okay. All right, so glucose going to pyruvic acid, we said we got what? A net of two ATPs. There's four that are produced, but it takes two ATPs to get glycolysis working. All right, but glycolysis also produces some NADH for us. But where does glycolysis take place? All right, so here's glycolysis, glucose to pyruvate. That's glycolysis. Where does that take place? In the cytosol. All right, but where does NADH work to produce ATP? It's not in the cytosol, it is inside the mitochondria. So guess what? It takes a little bit of energy to get NADH from the cytosol into the mitochondria. So NADH that's made in the cytosol doesn't make three ATPs. It really makes two ATPs because it gets converted into FADH2 when it enters the mitochondria. So cytosolic NADH doesn't produce quite as much ATP, right? You lose some going into the mitochondria. Okay, so the textbook used to make a big deal about the actual yield, the practical yield of ATP from all of these different processes, right? And it used to say that for every NADH, your body can make 2.5 ATPs. All right, but what did I put on the board? I have for every NADH, you can make 3 ATPs. All right, so that's just a classical understanding of how many ATPs are made for an NADH. And so that's what we call the theoretical yield. And so that's what I want you to focus on, not the practical or actual yield right here, because in fact, it's probably not 2.5. Right, it could be 2.6, it could be 2.758943, depending on the conditions. And scientists will be talking about that for probably another 1,000 years. So let's just simplify it and say that for every NADH, your body can make 3 ATPs, but in the back of your mind, realize that that's under the most optimal conditions that our body might operate under all time. But for any kind of calculations on a test, that's the one that works for me. You don't have to worry about fractions of ATP that are made. The same thing for FADH2. Right? FADH2, the theoretical maximum, is 2 ATPs. Right? Under other circumstances, it's going to be a little bit less. It might be 1.5, might be 1.6, might be 1.8. Okay, but I'm not really too concerned about all those other nonspecific cases. All right, so FADH2, you're always going to say what? 2 ATPs, and for NADH, you're going to say 3. But that's now inside the mitochondria. If you have NADH in the cytosol, don't forget, though, this is still important. NADH in the cytosol becomes FADH2 inside the mitochondria, so you still lose some energy. So cytosolic NADH can only produce what? 2 ATPs for every one that you have. All right, so this is the column that I'm most interested in right here. All right, so let's now just contrast and compare aerobic metabolism with anaerobic metabolism and look at the energy yield through those two different processes. All right, so what is anaerobic metabolism? It includes, what is this right here? Glycolysis. All right, and then the lactate dehydrogenase pathway producing lactic acid. All right, so what does glycolysis produce for us? Glycolysis, okay, produces a net 2 ATPs by what kind of phosphorylation? You're right, I hear it. Your idea is forming. Substrate level phosphorylation, that's right. Substrate level phosphorylation, not oxidative phosphorylation. All right, and it also produces 2 NADH. All right, so if you want to flip back to your slides and see where they're produced, that's fine, but that's just a nice synopsis of glycolysis. All right, that NADH has to enter the mitochondria, so it loses some ability to make ATP. Okay, so that is glycolysis. What do we have? All right, probably this line here you could cross out because it gets converted to FADH2. So, okay, 2 ATPs from direct or substrate level phosphorylation and 4 ATPs for oxidative phosphorylation, right? Because what does FADH do? It donates electrons to the electron transport chain at a lower energy level, so it can make, 2 ATPs, but for every glucose, how many pyruvates enter, or how many acetyl-CoAs enter the Krebs cycle, all right, for every glucose right here? There's 2. All right, so that's why we have times 2 right here, because glucose gets split in half. All right, so you get 2 NADHs, you get 2 FADHs, so 2 times 2 is 4. All right, so how many ATPs are produced? Let's see, but if we don't have oxygen, then these FADHs, that NADH doesn't donate electrons to the mitochondria. because under anaerobic conditions, mitochondria don't work. So under anaerobic conditions, what's the net production of ATP? You have to kiss this NADH goodbye under anaerobic conditions, right? So what are you left with? 2 ATP. Just plain old 2 ATP.
So on this slide right here, for anaerobic metabolism, just jot in 2 ATPs for every glucose molecule, okay, when you produce lactic acid. All right, so now let's look at this aerobic pathway. Right, the aerobic pathway, we still get 2 ATPs made by substrate-level phosphorylation, but what else did we get?
We got 2 NADHs.
Right, so let's go back to the table right here. We get these 2 NADHs, which become FADH2 inside the mitochondria. That produces these 4 ATP. All right, so I'm happy with that. But now, pyruvate under aerobic conditions isn't converted to lactic acid. What happens to pyruvate during under aerobic conditions? It enters the mitochondria, all right, and it is decarboxylated. And here's the preparatory reaction. Pyruvate gets converted into acetyl-CoA. But in the process, right, that is an oxidation reduction reaction that produces NADH. You can maybe flip back in your slides. And you know what? Maybe I will over here. Where's that at? Where's that reaction at? Ah, right here. Here's the reaction. Pyruvic acid being converted into acetyl-CoA. That produces what? NADH. All right, and this is now inside the mitochondria. So what about this NADH? It doesn't have to be converted into FADH2. It can be used to directly transfer those electrons to ETC. And so we're going to say 2 NADHs. How many ATPs for every NADH would be? 3. So 3 times 2 is 6. All right, that's... Oh, let me get this back on the projector right. Sorry. I got to click, and then what? Like this.
Okay, so 6 ATPs. All right, where does acetyl-CoA go? Acetyl-CoA goes into the Krebs cycle right here. And what did we write down for the number of ATPs that are produced by just the Krebs cycle? Okay, we've got 12 right here.
All right, let's look in a little bit more detail. So Krebs cycle, we have 1 ATP made by substrate-level phosphorylation. All right, but it also produces 3 NADHs, 1 FADH2 for every, what, turn of the Krebs cycle right here. So we've got 3 times 2 is 6, then times 2 for FADH. Okay, and so that leaves us with 18 ATPs from NADH, 4 ATPs from FADH2. All right, so look at our maximum yield, right? It's going to be about 34 ATPs for aerobic respiration. And we should probably also add these 4 ATPs over here by direct level phosphorylation. So the maximum yield from every glucose molecule run through aerobic respiration is, okay, 38 ATPs. That's the maximum. Aerobic respiration. What did we say the maximum was for anaerobic respiration? Was only 2. All right, so let's now compare those two metabolic pathways. So let's consider that you need gas on the way home. You need some energy. What's the energy in your body that you use? It's ATP. But what kind of energy does your car use? It doesn't use ATP. It uses gasoline, right? So you're going to stop at a gasoline station, and 2 of them are open. And you have a choice of which one you want to go to. And let's just say that the price per gallon at these 2 gas stations is exactly the same. So it's $5 per gallon, no matter which one you go to. But one gas station has a gas that's a quality that you can get 2 miles per gallon. And the other gas station, you can get 38 miles per gallon. Which one are you going to go to?
38.
Yeah, the 38, right? So which metabolic process gives you a better bang for the buck, which is glucose? Is it aerobic or anaerobic respiration? Obviously, it's aerobic respiration, right? So you can go a lot farther via aerobic respiration compared to anaerobic respiration. So that's the important thing to consider. All right, but you need some additional machinery in order to do that. All right. Now, what about that lactate dehydrogenase reaction? We did mention this last time. Let's look at the PowerPoint slide over here. What's the purpose of this reaction right here, the LDH reaction? This will review a couple concepts for us.
Where is that? That is, let me flip back on this slide over here. That is the conversion of pyruvic acid to lactic acid over here. Why is that such an important reaction?
Because if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cytoplasm and it can't get into the mitochondria under anaerobic conditions, what is the buildup of pyruvic acid going to do? And it's going to have an effect on the process that I have the arrow by. Glycolysis. What effect is a buildup of pyruvic acid going to have on glycolysis? It's going to stop it. By what principle could you invoke to explain that? Maybe end product inhibition. That's a pretty good one. But something even simpler than that. And that would be, but no, it works. That's a good one. End product inhibition will inhibit these metabolic pathways right here. But also, Le Chatelier's principle. What is that? The law of mass action just says that when a product builds up, it has a tendency to force the reaction to go in the reverse direction, right? So when pyruvic acid builds up, it actually kind of poisons glycolysis from operating, and then you don't even get those two measly ATPs, right? So that just stops glycolysis. So what's a good thing to do with pyruvic acid? Well, yeah, get rid of it. Get it out of the cell. How do you get it out of the cell? Convert it into lactic acid, and then lactic acid can leave the cell. All right, and so that will keep glycolysis operating. All right, so pyruvic acid is taken out. It's got, wrong one. Where is it? This is it right here. All right, so pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid. And as glycolysis is operating, as glucose is converted into pyruvic acid, besides pyruvic acid building up, there's also another important intermediate that's not on the particular slide that I'm on right now that's also building up. What's another intermediate that builds up during glycolysis? That can be used to make ATP, but can't enter the mitochondria under anaerobic conditions. It is NADH, right? Let's see. Let me click over here. NADH. Yeah, look, NADH is being made by glycolysis. All right, so if NADH builds up inside the cell, that is going to work by Le Chatelier's principle to what? Also prevent glycolysis from working in the forward direction. All right, but there's another consideration. In order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction, it needs a substrate. And that substrate is not NADH, it is NAD. So the LDH reaction produces NAD plus so that glycolysis can operate because it's a substrate, and in so doing it gets rid of NADH, which would actually have a tendency to slow glycolysis down. So this is an important reaction under anaerobic conditions. Sometimes we call that anaerobic fermentation or lactate fermentation. Call that lactate fermentation. Now some of you maybe have worked with this in lab. What kind of fermentation process and lab have you worked with? You didn't use lactate fermentation, you used yeast, okay, and yeast have a little bit different enzyme. Yeast can, let's see, I think I can erase something right here. I can erase this for right now. So let's look at this reaction. So yeast under anaerobic conditions, so let's just consider anaerobic conditions. Yeast aren't too particular. They can do just fine with a low-level production of ATP like anaerobic metabolism producing two ATPs for every glucose. We can't because we have much more sophistication in our, per se, nervous system. But for instance, in yeast, we have pyruvate. How many carbons are in pyruvate? Can you remember? Pyruvate has got, it's got three. Okay, pyruvate will be converted into ethyl alcohol. All right, so these lines just represent hydrogen atoms. All right, so here is an OH, So it is an alcohol. But we got two carbons right here. What did we start out with? We started out with three. So what do we got? We have to have
one more carbon someplace.
Okay, and that is going to be CO2. Produces CO2. So yeast produce those that gas, which ends up as a bubble. What can you do with that gas? Exhale it. Ah, but yeast don't breathe in and out. A yeast is just
a little simple cell like that.
It's a eukaryotic cell. It does have mitochondria, but those mitochondria inside a yeast aren't operating because we've taken oxygen away from them. They don't have oxygen. But they still want to run glycolysis so they can make some ATP. So with pyruvate, what do they do with pyruvate? Convert it into ethyl alcohol, right? ETOH, and CO2. And the question was, what could you do with that CO2? Well, you could use that CO2 to make bread rise up when you're cooking, right? So you use yeast in baking products. But you also make yeast, for instance, if you want a carbonated beverage, like beer or champagne, something like that. And you can end up with beer and champagne because what is beer and champagne? It's an adult beverage, which contains what? Ethyl alcohol right here. So you got all the ingredients, so that's why yeast is used. Sorry about this. This is still really good.
I have no idea why it's falling off like that.
Okay, I've got it clipped pretty good. Stay down. Okay, so this is what we call alcohol fermentation. It's not lactate fermentation. Yeast have this enzyme right here. And under what conditions does this happen? With oxygen or without oxygen? Without oxygen. So I'm just going to put a big X right here. Okay, so that's a pretty nifty reaction that a yeast can undergo. But now, why doesn't this work for a human? Why do we have the lactate dehydrogenase pathway and not the alcohol dehydrogenase pathway? Anybody have a clue? I know you all know the answer. Well, I think that's exactly the right answer, because what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol right here? Well, it's toxic to our nervous system, right? When you drink beer and champagne, you get intoxicated, and if your body produced that all the time, well, then you would be intoxicated all the time. And if that was a pathway for you, what is one way you could speed up your intoxication? By just holding your breath. All right? But since yeast don't have a nervous system, they really don't care if they're, right? They can't become intoxicated. But you have a nervous system that's very sensitive to ethyl alcohol. All right, so what pathway do you have instead? You have the lactate dehydrogenase pathway instead of the alcohol dehydrogenase pathway. Okay, so it's going to be important to understand something about these different carbon fragments. Sometime soon, I want to talk about this molecule again. So ethyl alcohol has how many carbon units in it? It's got two. There is another compound that has two carbons in it that we've talked about and made a big deal about it. And where was that at? Do you remember another two-carbon fragment that we talked about? We talked about a six-carbon. What's a good six-carbon molecule? Glucose. What's a good three-carbon molecule? Lactate or pyruvic acid. Okay, but what about a two-carbon unit that we talked about? Ah, exactly right. We see it on the slide right here. Right, an acetyl group is what's donated. Acetyl group is a two-carbon group right here that's donated to the Krebs cycle, right, to produce a lot of ATP for us. So there's a lot of energy in ethyl alcohol. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. All right, there's a couple other things yet that we've got to talk about in this chapter. So I'm not too concerned that you know the actual yield of ATP versus the theoretical yield of ATP by aerobic respiration. Okay, I certainly want you to know the difference between anaerobic and aerobic. So the important concept is for anaerobic, you can produce 2 ATP, and for anaerobic respiration, you can produce 30-something, right? So it's a big difference. So it's 2 versus 30-something. So that is the important thing. All right, but I do want you to know the difference between substrate-level phosphorylation and oxidative phosphorylation, where they take place, and something about the chemiasmotic theory, because this figure right here is an exam figure, right? So make sure you're familiar with the membrane systems inside of mitochondria and the chemical gradient of protons. And what does ATP synthase use to make ATP? Remember, producing ATP is an endergonic reaction. There has to be an exergonic reaction attached to it. What's the exergonic reaction attached to ATP synthase to make ATP? It's the transport of protons down the gradient back into the matrix. That's an exergonic reaction that ATP synthase can capture that energy and make ATP out of it. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. And so these pumps right here, these proteins right here are pumps. So they're channels that actually pump protons up into this high concentration right here. And so remember, a pump is something that needs energy to work. So it's not just a channel for diffusion. It requires an energy source. And we've looked at an energy source before. We said primary active transport, which uses what molecule directly? Is primary active transport is ATP driven. And then secondary active transport is using a gradient of some other molecule. So this is not really all that different a scheme than secondary active transport that you're kind of familiar with already. All right, so this proton pump does not use ATP to move from low to high concentration. It uses another energy source, which is what, those high energy electrons. ATP synthase uses the gradient. So these are all active transporters right here, but they're not primary active transport because ATP is not being used up. Okay, so it's a different kind of thing. All right, so let's look at some other molecules. So this slide right here in your notes, probably you should crumple up and just look at the slide that's in your textbook, which has another nice column right here, theoretical yield. That's the one that I like. All right, so 30-something versus 2-something for anaerobic respiration. All right, let's talk a little bit about some fat and protein metabolism. All right, so what the heck is a fat? Let's lay some definitions out before we start to think about this. You're familiar with a fat, and you've had fat measured maybe in your blood if you've ever had a blood test. What's the name of that fat that they measure in your blood? Triglycerides, right? And so you should remember the building block of a triglyceride. I'm sure that was on the first test someplace. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? Three fatty acids. So a fat can be broken down, right, hydrolyzed to glycerol and three fatty acids. Those are the building blocks. And that's a hydrolysis reaction. And if we take three fatty acids and bind it to glycerol, then that would be what? A synthetic reaction, a dehydration synthetic reaction. All right, and glycerol is a three-carbon unit. Maybe you remember that. And glycerol is actually a part of glycolysis. It's an intermediate of glycolysis. So your body can make glycerol all the time, and you can get it in your diet. It's not essential because you can make it via glycolysis. And fatty acids your body can make, or you can get fatty acids in your diet. But can you remember what a fatty acid looks like? Is it three carbons? No, it's really long. It's a really long hydrocarbon chain. All right, so this first process of taking a triglyceride and breaking it down to glycerol and fatty acids is what we call lipolysis. All right, lipolysis, is that on this slide anywhere? Yeah, it's not. Maybe it's on the next one. Okay, lipolysis. And so what kind of enzyme can make glycerol from three fatty acids? It would be called a lipase. Right? Lipase can convert a triglyceride into glycerol and fatty acids. All right? Proteins can be broken down into its building blocks, which are amino acids. And there is what? There's an amino group on amino acids, and that has to be taken off the amino acid before the carbon chain can be put into other kinds of metabolism, like the Krebs cycle. Oh, what's the point of Krebs cycle again? What's the point of all this stuff over here? Oh, I got to hit this arrow. What's the point of all this stuff, including Krebs cycle? Make ATP. Right, so amino acids can be used to make ATP under certain conditions. And so these different pathways can interconvert carbohydrates and proteins, usually because of the Krebs cycle right here. All right, but fats can't be really converted. So this statement is a little bit leading. We'll show you why. Fats cannot be converted into proteins, and fats cannot be converted into carbohydrates. That's a really important thing. All right, once you have carbon incorporated into a fat, it can only be used to make energy via the Krebs cycle, or it's stored in your body. All right, so if you want to gain lean body mass and strong muscles, you can't just eat fats. It's only energy source. It can't build muscles because muscles are made out of proteins right here. Okay. So here we have glycolysis. Here is one of the intermediates of glycolysis. It has three carbons. It can be made into glycerol. Right? And acetyl-CoA, how many carbons are in acetyl-CoA?
Two.
Those two carbon fragments can be added together to make a fatty acid. So how do you make a fatty acid? With two carbons at a time. So you can make fatty acids that are what? Four carbons long, or six, or eight, right? Or 10, 12, 14, so some even number of carbon atoms. And then you have fatty acids and glycerol that can be used to make a fat. So what do you use to break down a fat into glycerol and three fatty acids? That would be lipase, right? And then lipase makes fatty acids. Fatty acids inside a mitochondria can be broken down into acetyl-CoA. And how many carbons are in acetyl-CoA? Two. So two carbons at a time, a fatty acid will be converted into an intermediate that can be used to make energy with the Krebs cycle. So a fatty acid will be chopped off, not like glucose and glycolysis, not in half, but what? Two carbons at a time. Okay. Now, to go from acetyl-CoA to pyruvate, how many carbons are in pyruvic acid once again?
Three.
Notice, how many arrows do you see right here? Only one. You can't use acetyl-CoA to make pyruvic acid, which means then you can't use acetyl-CoA to make what? Glucose. You can't use acetyl-CoA to make glucose. And in our bodies, we can't use acetyl-CoA to make proteins either, or amino acids. What's the only thing you can do with acetyl-CoA in your body? Make fats out of it, or make ATP out of it. Those are the only two possible fates. Okay, and we have to stop, but we're going to start talking there next time. So don't forget about that two-carbon unit. That's important. Yeah, then we excrete the CO2. If you're exercising fast, hard enough, then you can actually convert these fatty acids into CO2, and that's a really good way to, if you're concerned about weight management, for instance. So it has to do with energy balance.